Thank you. It's great to be here, and good afternoon. There are, we're entering what I think is a new era of science and scholarship, and in the next few minutes I'll touch upon what some of this entails, and then as we move into this new era, I think that creates some real challenges for us as well, which I'll spell out related to data and information. And then finally, I'm going to conclude with some solutions that we're working on Data One to help alleviate some of these challenges and make it easier for scientists to do their work. As you can see here, a lot of the new science that we're tackling is of societal relevance, and in this particular case, the science indicated is all team-based, it's highly collaborative in nature, requires a lot of data, and it's actually quite challenging, requiring many decades and many different scales of data availability. One of the new paradigm changes as well is that data are now being viewed as valuable resources of the scientific enterprise. And then you can see this example from Dryad. And this shows not only the DOI for the publication, but it shows the digital object identifier for the data product, which is located in the data repository. One of the other big changes in this new era of science and scholarship is the new roles that libraries are taking on. And you'll see in this particular picture that there are no books in sight. Essentially, we see lots of collaborative workspaces. We see a visualization wall where a lot of activity is taking place, and then in our library in particular, in New Mexico, we're rapidly shrinking down the space that is allocated for books using stackable and movable shelves, and then we're creating more and more of these collaboration spaces. The fourth paradigm change that's occurring as we're moving into this new era is one that I think everyone here is familiar with. That is the move into data-intensive science. And this follows the three previous paradigms as outlined by Jim Gray and included in the Microsoft book by Tony Hay and his colleagues. And you can see the fourth paradigm of data-intensive research, which follows observational experimental research, theoretical research, and then computer simulation activities. The fifth major paradigm change that's accompanying this move into a new era of science and scholarship, or grand challenge science, as I might call it, is that data management or informatics is becoming, quote, the new statistics. And when many of us went through school, statistics was a required course that we all had to take, and that helped us with preparing for and planning and doing our research experiments and so on using some of the most cutting-edge scientific or statistical methods. Nowadays, I would argue that we need similar training in relation to data management and informatics, starting early on in students' careers. These could be incorporated into regular student classes like Biology 101 and Physics 101 and so on, and then there can also be more advanced classes as well. But clearly we do need much more training for students in terms of how to deal with this deluge of data that we're now seeing. The grand challenges that we're facing in science are accompanied by additional challenges in the informatics arena, and this is not easy, as I'll demonstrate in the next few slides. First of all, we continue to be plagued with what I refer to as data entropy, and that is that data products are typically not documented or described to the extent that's necessary for reproducibility of science, or even for reproducibility of science by others, but also by reproducibility, I mean by ourselves as well. So it's not even possible for any of us to reproduce the science projects or experiments that we did several years ago because we did not include adequate documentation. The second challenge that we face from an informatics perspective is what Brian Heidorn describes as the long tail problem. And this points to the fact that most of the data products that are out there now, particularly in terms of volume, are associated with very large data repositories like GenBank, Protein Data Bank, NASA and the European Space Agency have their repositories for remotely sensed data. But yet, the bulk of the numbers of data sets are actually quite small. And in many cases, they're not affiliated with a repository, and they are not preserved for the long term, nor are they well described in a manner that can be reproduced for the long term as well. Another major challenge I see is that the repositories that do exist, and it's been estimated that there are roughly 5 million repositories worldwide for data, they all essentially exist as standalone repositories. So if you want to go and discover a particular type of data, you either have to know the specific repository you want to go to and you hope that the data are there, or you have to search through many, many, many different repositories. As an example, just before I came here, I ran a Google search on soil organic carbon. I had close to 3 million hits, and most of them, or almost none of them, were data repositories and included the data that I would have been looking for. So a final challenge that I think is really critical, I refer to as the 80-20 problem, and that is we're working on these grand challenge science questions, and we're working across multiple scales of space and time, then it's quite difficult to do so. As you can see here, we might want remotely sensed data. We might also want data from extensive research sites like long-term ecological research sites, and then we might also want data from environmental observatory systems like NEON in the U.S. or others that are worldwide. This is really a major challenge right now in terms of trying to do that. And what this means is that roughly about 80% of a scientist's time is spent trying to discover and integrate those data, and only 20% is actually spent on the interpretation and analysis and the real thought-provoking part of science that we all enjoy. So that leads to data one and then some of the solutions that we're trying to employ. So here I illustrate the data lifecycle. And as you can see, there are four simple questions that are being asked. And we've gotten these from interviews with scientists worldwide, as well as various surveys that we've conducted, one which was published last fall in PLOS. Well, let's look at just four questions that have arisen, and they're questions associated with every aspect of the data lifecycle. But the first one is, what is a data management plan? You know, as many funding agencies require data management plans, scientists are saying, okay, well, what should I include in one? What are the components? Where can I get more information? Secondly, where can I preserve my data? So once I've completed a study or partway through it, where can I archive my data for the long term? A third question is, how can I find similar data? So if I'm trying to integrate My day is set with others to look for broader generalities. I also want to be able to discover other similar data sets very easily. And then finally, the fourth question is, how can I best analyze my data? And this is particularly challenging now that we have huge streams of data coming in. Many of these are from sensors, and Hewlett-Packard estimates that there are over 1 billion sensors in the environment as of this past year. So this means that we have just a real deluge of data to try and analyze and visualize. So the answer to the first question is, what should be included in a data management plan is answered by a tool that we've been working on, and this is based on an initial tool that was created by the Digital Curation Center in the UK. But we've modified it and expanded and added some additional features to it for programs and projects in the US, including the National Science Foundation, several other federal funding agencies, as well as private foundations. And as you can see here, this is a tool that helps scientists create those 1 to 2 page data management plans that are required by research sponsors. So it does this by first of all logging in. In this case, I've logged into the program. The pointer's not working here, but at the very top, you can name your plan, whatever language you choose. You can identify the solicitation number or the request for proposal number that would point the program officer to that. And then you can include some specific comments. And if you look at the far left, those are the 5 steps of the creating the data management plan in this particular case. This is a generic plan for the National Science Foundation. And these 5 steps have to do with things like how are the data formatted, where did they come from, same thing with metadata, and then there are several that have to do with different types of policies and so on. The last one, for example, deals with preservation of data. So jumping right down, this is the 5th step in the plan right here. You can see that we're typing, we've got some suggested text that's been provided by one of the users. In this case, this is the University of Virginia, and they've got specific recommendations for how data are preserved. So that flashes up in that upper gray box. And that entire text can then be cut and pasted into the plan itself, which is the white area in the bottom. And this is really quite handy for most universities or research networks or private agencies, federal agencies, and so on, to provide guidance to their particular users. And then finally, when all is said and done, one ends up with a, in this case, a 2-page data management plan. This is essentially as it came out of the program after I completed it. And this is, I just completed this for a project that I submitted to the National Science Foundation about 2.5 months ago. So it works like a charm, and I would encourage everyone to give it a try. So here's the location for it. It's currently operated or housed at the California Digital Library in the U.S. The second question is, where do I archive or store my data? And this goes to the Data One infrastructure that we're in the process of completing and getting ready to open up for worldwide use within the next couple weeks. And this shows 3 different components to the Data One architecture. So the first one you see here, this is just a small number of data repositories that we're adding into the infrastructure. So these are data centers or data repositories or archives, whatever terminology you might use. But these are where primary data are stored, and they can be libraries, they can be museums, research networks, and so on. And they typically serve a particular user community, like library stakeholders, or in the case of the Long-Term Ecological Research Program, that would house LTER data that have been now in the U.S. at least collected for over 30-some years. The second component I show here is the triangles, and these are what we refer to as coordinating nodes. And these essentially provide that interoperability infrastructure that supports a number of the key activities we need to easily preserve data in multiple locations following something similar to the LOX principle, as well as to easily discover data that are indexed through the indexing services provided through these Data One coordinating nodes. And we do a lot of other things at the coordinating nodes as well, including we have them act as replication nodes. We also support a number of security activities through there, federated identity and authorization, and so on. And then a third key component that we've added in is what we call Investigator Toolkit, and this provides access to tools that are tightly integrated with the Data One data, and they're usually familiar tools to all of you and the scientists that are working in various fields. So someone could come in using, for example, Excel or MATLAB, one of the other analytical programs, and they would. The tool is essentially a plug-in, and it allows you to easily connect up to the Data One, all the Data One resources. You can identify the specific data sets that you wish to pull down and very easily do that. So in our first iteration, these are a number of the various data repositories worldwide that we're interacting with and will be trying to incorporate into our infrastructure within the next couple years. It takes a while to get a big project like this up and running. We were funded about 2.5 years ago, so we're just about to the point of being able to release the first 8 member nodes and then the 3 coordinating nodes, and then after that we'll have a rapid exponential increase in the number of member nodes or data repositories that are added in over the next few years. So how does this work? This gives one example from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory Distributed Active Archive Center for Biogeochemical Dynamics. They handle a lot of data for NASA, and this archive has existed for about 15 years, and they've got a whole user base that takes advantage of the DAC. Now, when they join Data One, there are some real benefits. The users of the DAC can then access other tools that are available through the Data One architecture. They can also access other data that are available in other data repositories and that are open for public consumption. And then more importantly, it exposes lots of other users that use Data One to the data and tools and so on that are associated with the ORNL DAC. So it's a win-win for everyone by adopting this architecture. So I won't go into any great detail here because of time limits, but I just want to point out that we have different tiers of implementation. The first one is what we refer to as a generic member node, which is quite easy to install and get up and running. This provides access to the read-only data that are present in various repositories or member nodes, all the way up through level 4, which provides that really tight integration between the data, you can read and write data, as well as you can, the data are tightly integrated again with the tools and the toolkit. So this gives an indication of the various tools that support all aspects of the data lifecycle that we're planning to incorporate into Data One over the next 1 to 2 years. We'll have about half a dozen of these available upon release, and I'll show one or two of these in the next few slides. We've already gotten, for example, the data management planning tool is one of the tools that's in the initial release of Data 1. Another tool is what we refer to as 1 Mercury, and that's shown here. And this is a fairly easy to use, well, very easy to use interface. It's much like Google. The front page is essentially you can type in one line or a couple keywords, and it'll pull up, you know, X number of hits. But more importantly, it's a faceted search engine, so you can dig down and you can search by spatially and temporal bounding boxes and so on. And then there are a number of other parameters you can search by, including sensors, authors, repositories, and eventually you can get down to the specific data sets that you're particularly interested in, and they're all related by relevance factors. And then on the right side, on the left, the two boxes on the right side, you can see one that says find similar data. So we've incorporated some semantic tools in there as well to help you find data that are similar to the data that you were included in your initial search. So once the data are found, then they can be easily incorporated into your own specific workspace. And this is called the Data 1 Drive, which will also be available in the early releases. And it allows you, again, to build up your own collection of data sets around a particular topic. So one of the things this does is, you can see here, is it allows us to get access to data from multiple sources. On the left, I show 31 different sources. In the center, we've used what we call a compute node, the TerraGrid, about 600,000 hours of CPU time to complete all the analyses for several hundred bird species. And then on the right, we're seeing an animation using VisTrails, which shows the distribution of indigo buntings as they move up the East Coast. Dark dots over like Atlanta are areas that are being actively avoided by the birds. They much prefer going through natural forest and grassland areas. And this particular set of analyses was used in the creation of the 2011 State of the Birds report for the U.S. So a couple of key dates I wanted to point out. One, we have a Data 1 users group meeting coming up in July 15th and 16th of this year. This will be held in Madison, Wisconsin. If you're interested in potentially joining, and we have many European partners in this, I would encourage you to come to the meeting. Look up Data 1 users group, and that should take you straight to it. And then you can also contact the names up here to get more information as well. And then secondly, another date I wanted to point to is one that is in August, and this is held in conjunction with the Ecological Society of America meeting. And this will be the first international effort to try and bring together all of the various citizen science programs that exist worldwide. And we'll be covering things like best practices, what are some of the key challenges that all these citizen science programs face. And it should be a really exciting and innovative meeting. So if you're interested in citizen science programs, I want to encourage you to attend this meeting. And we seem to be hung on the last slide. Okay, and this is just to point out the website here, data1.org. There should be an animation running in the lower right, but we seem to have a little glitch there. But anyway, I'll be glad to answer any questions if there is time to do so.
Yeah, we still have a few minutes. So thank you very much. We thank the speaker.